Chapter 1. So it came about on a bitter and freezing Wednesday in February at the beginning of the new millennium that Charles Vincent Gauntlet married Rebecca Louise Olisker at a civil ceremony with people pulled in off the street as witnesses. They'd lived together in Bex's flat in Dolphin Square for some months, and in spite of the perceptible age difference, were as happy as they had any right to be, if not happier. Bex was particularly suited, for her work was, well, let's just say that any partner had to really understand the job. She'd given up looking for a husband when she first met Gauntlet. It had always been such a letdown. Men never understood, or they wanted to know more, or they just got jealous of the Metropolitan Police Force. Being a detective chief inspector in the Met was bad enough, but to be in the anti-terrorist OS-13 branch was something else. They'd met at the funeral of a colleague.
"You knew old Herbie for long?"
Charlie asked her. It was almost a chat-up line, and he was quite surprised when Bex said that she'd done some quite wild things with Herbie. "It was sudden," she said, giving a sad little smile, her big brown eyes drooping away. "Very quick, I understand." Charlie Gauntlet gave her a kind of bracing nod. This time, her eyes locked on him, lips trembling.
"Happened in my sitting room." Her voice cracked. "There one minute, gone the next. Silly bugger. He went from life to death in the snap of your fingers. Poor old Herb. And now she fixed him with her eyes, so that he felt like an insect skewered against a mount, and was totally lost to her.
What do you do for a living?" Bex asked him sweetly.
"Me? I'm retired. Like old Herb was, out to grass."
Now, if anyone asked Charles Gauntlet what he had done, he would give a wry smile and mutter that he read law at Cambridge, but eventually, before he was really ready, went on to do something dodgy for the Foreign Service. Their mutual dead friend Herbie had worked for the same firm, only his job had been even more dodgy.
"Should have died years ago, Herb,"
one of his other iffy colleagues had said.
"Took a lot of risks when the curtain was still up."
So that was how Charlie and Bex first got together. Only Charles had taken early retirement, and one of the boons he brought to the relationship, and thence to the marriage, was that he was very much an ex-government employee who knew exactly how to keep his trap shut and not ask awkward questions. He knew how to see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, which to Bex's mind was bloody nigh impossible. In retrospect, the marriage was quirky because she wasn't looking for a husband. Sure, sometimes her thoughts strayed to the idea of tying the knot. Then, like a sniper with a plethora of targets, she switched and considered better of it. That was until the Saturday evening when she came back to Dolphin Square and told him that, barring accidents and a change in the wind, she had 5 days free.
"What do you want to do then, Bex?"
he growled, looking up, innocent, and paradoxically wise at the same time. The stare said, "Okay, Bex, you want to go to the movies, or are we seeing Les Miserables for the 36th time and having a good cry? You want to go out and live it up?" Which meant, have an Indian or a Chinese, or even an Italian. "Or you want to go to the movies, see Laurel and Hardy or Charlie Chaplin, like I first suggested?" Later she realized that Charlie, cunning bugger that he was, had led her into a trap simply by the way he looked, by his body language and the tilt of his mouth. He was suggesting that probably there was something exceptionally good to see at the movies, and after that they could have a Madras chicken with Bombay potatoes and lashings of onion pickle, and it wouldn't matter. "What do you want to do, my darling? You choose for a change." She could almost taste the Madras chicken. She was a martyr to Madras chicken.
"Okay."
He shifted on the settee next to her, one hand straying to her thigh, grinned, dropped his voice, almost picked it up again, and whispered,
"Well, I'm getting married Wednesday, if you agree."
She did a double take, then a treble.
He's joking. No, he's not, the bastard. I can see it in that sly little look he's trying to pull. Gotcha. Charlie?
Stern and very grown up. The grin widened.
Charlie, you've set me up.
Only if you want it. Only if you want to get married, Bex. Make an honest man of me.
You've arranged it already.
She remembered that he'd quizzed her several weeks before. Got to make some arrangements, Bex, for when your next leave comes up. Your away days, right? Maybe we do something stupid, like take the bus out to Hampton Court, see the armour. Do something daft like get married.
She heard her own voice hurtling from a few weeks ago. That'll be the day, Charlie. I should live so long.
He now gave her another quick grin, flashing on and off like an Aldous lamp. So?
Eyebrows lifting, eyes dancing, winking a challenge.
She took a deep breath and committed herself. So, the police officer and the former lawyer with special duties and dark secrets were married on that raw, cold Tuesday with a delivery man, a lady bank clerk, a council worker, and a housewife. Only you cannot marry a house, so she called herself a wife, as the witnesses. And a woman registrar beamed, looking like a coiffured owl as she pronounced them man and wife. After that, Charlie Gauntlet took Bex in his arms, as though she were a fragile piece of porcelain, which she was not, and kissed her as tenderly as she would ever want to be kissed. And she wondered at the whole business. After all, we were up to our asses in platitudes about family values on the one hand, while people had cast matrimony to the waves on the other. Nowadays people have partners and all that. We also have a lot of non-nuclear single-parent happy families. Anyway, they went out onto the ice-slick pavements and hailed a cab to take them to the little Italian place off Fleet Street, where they let the padrone into the secret, and he treated them to a bottle of champagne on the house. They ate minestrone, calves, liver and onions, tomatoes floating in olive oil and a dash of vinegar. The wedding cake was an apple tort off the trolley, with a fistful of cream, and they ordered brandy with the coffee. Then they went home for the honeymoon, where Charlie announced that he had tickets for the Flying Dutchman that night.
Not really the most popular choice these days, Charles, she joked.
Who's worried by popular?
She explained that opera was, wrongly, considered elitist by many, particularly the current establishment, which made him glum, for he'd always been politically slightly left of centre. Even so, he had been a shade-cutting when the Prime Minister and the Chancellor had both chosen Madonna, Oasis, Boyzone and Michael Jackson on BBC Radio's Desert Island Discs.
Thought they were adults,
he said again now, when his new wife explained the state of the musical nation to him.
Don't stop me liking opera. Spice Girls aren't obligatory, are they?
Let's have a little lie down first, darling.
She didn't even blush, trollop that she could be when it came to country matters.
Again, she was amazed at what Charlie, at slightly less than twice her age, could pull off when he tried. She'd learned that if she was not greedy, and if she allowed him to pace himself, she could not want for a better, more satisfying, and attentive lover. The truth about Charlie Gauntlet was that age had not withered him. He really was the kind of guy to whom age did not matter, either to him or to the people he was with. Adult women, unless they had some seriously sorry hang-up, truly did not think of him as late, middle, or even early old, aged. Charlie was, well, simply Charlie, a man of the 20th century, who did not pin himself down, could not attach himself to a particular decade. Just as, until the closing years of the century, he was never one to really ally himself to any political ideology.